Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Church Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now in a moment, I'll be joined by my co-host, Mike Neff, to discuss a doublehead weekend of racing on a pair of road courses for the Xfinity and Truck Series. Now that Christopher Bell has won on a road course, what's left there for him to do at the Xfinity level? Also, Neff and I will discuss if Brett Moffitt is the championship favorite in the Truck Series after winning the first two races in the playoffs. Then we'll dig deep into the truck schedule now that there are only five races remaining in the 2019 season, as well as Tyler Dipple getting suspended indefinitely by NASCAR, as did Matt Borland for a chemical in his diet coffee. Finally, Eric Jones joins the show to discuss his 2019 season and previewing the playoffs, believing his 20 team is entering the postseason under the radar. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on Apple Podcasts, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk some road course racing with Neff. All right, Neff, no cup racing this past weekend, but we did get a pretty good pair of Xfinity and Truck Series road courses, in my opinion. We'll stick with the Xfinity Series first. They went to Road America. It was a pretty good race, I thought. You know, Christopher Bell, Matt DiBenedetto were kind of the class of the fields. But Christopher Bell ended up on top, Neff, and, you know, he always says that he's not a good road racer. Well, now he's crossed that, you know, in the checkbox.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. We all know that Christopher Bell is a generational talent, and it's just a matter of time of him getting the seat time and the practice to be great at everything. I guess now the only thing he's got left is super speedways. Yeah. He said he's not the best on that. But yeah, he's done well on road courses all year long, and it doesn't hurt that you're in one of the best cars in the series. I mean, that helps when you've got that, you know, extra power under the hood and it's handling great, makes it easier to race it. But I mean, he put on a clinic, did it the way you're supposed to do it, and the only thing I wish we had is a view of what happened to DiBenedetto in the last corner.
Yeah.
As near as I can tell, he screwed it up himself. I don't think he got hit or there was contact, but we don't know, and it would be nice if we had a view of it. But nobody talked about there being any contact, so it makes me feel like there wasn't, and that he just tire hopped it and blew through the corner. But it was cool to watch. I mean, it was cool to watch him have a good day, and it was pretty neat just the racing in general. I thought that race can be a real disaster sometimes. But it felt like everybody had their heads on straight and drove within themselves for the most part. We had a couple of them getting off on that one corner repeatedly. But other than that, I thought it was a pretty good race technically from pretty much everybody in it.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we were talking offline about how DiBenedetto was on the Dell Jr. download this week. And, yeah, he mentioned how he said it was the worst mistake he's ever made. He put that on Twitter, too, I believe. And he said Sunday morning he couldn't even get out of bed, that his wife Taylor had to kind of force him out of bed because he was just so frustrated with the decision that he made. Apparently, you know, Austin Cindric was like a bat out of hell on that final restart with fresh tires. Came from 20th to 2nd. And he just didn't want to be in his way, but he also wanted to keep the spot, but he didn't want to come down on his nose, like across his nose. And he just got up in the marbles and spun out. So, you know, that's coming from the driver's mouth. I wish we had a replay too. You'd have thought we would, since it's the last corner of the...
Yeah. Pretty sure they have a fixed camera right there.
Yeah, you'd think. So, yeah, I guess that's how that happened. But, yeah, Christopher Bell, like you said, you know, he's a generational talent. We've seen this. His 6th win of the season, 14th of his career in Xfinity, Neff. And this isn't a guy that has a ton of starts. I mean, he's got 64 starts. 14 wins and 64 starts. So that's one out of every four almost. That's pretty damn good. It's Kyle Busch level.
Absolutely. And he's, yeah, you've got that right. It's Kyle Busch level from somebody that isn't at Kyle Busch level yet. You know, it's one thing that Kyle went back and won all those races, but it was a matter of he came up to Cup and then kind of went back and did that. It wasn't that he was really that dominant when he first came up. And Bell is doing it, excuse me, on his way up. And that, yeah, that bodes well that it's going to be, and we've said it for years on this thing, that the talent coming into the Cup race, Cup level, is ridiculous. It's just a matter of, are we going to have the equipment to be able to showcase that talent. I'm still on the fence about that. But, you know, it's the rookie of the year battle could be pretty intense next year.
So let's dig a little deeper into this Bell case, because we've talked about him a lot on this podcast, and rightfully so with all the wins. But Neff, we've talked about this too before, you know, recently on this podcast. All these young drivers, they come up and they don't have a ton of success. Yes, they have success at the lower levels, but like Chase Elliott, I would say out of in the past probably 5 years of drivers that have come up, he's been the guy that's kind of stood out. And that's only because he's got, what, 5 wins in the past little over a year now. But you got, you know, Christopher Bell's had all this success at Xfinity and trucks. We expect him to go to the 95. I would guess that's where he's going to go, unless they decide to move Jones to the 95, put Bell in the 20. But I don't see why they would. I would imagine that Levine, we talked about this last week too, how Levine's probably going to, you know, get more assets from Gibbs because, let's face it, Bell's under contract with Gibbs. What do you kind of see him doing as we go forward? And, you know, we say he's a generational talent, but the 95 team, like, yes, De Benedetto's done well over the past 3 months or so, but they're still below 20th in points.
I'm trying to remember, but I believe Furniture Row was around 20th in points back at one point in time. And then Joe Gibbs got on board and they put a lot of effort and time and money and backing into it, and they won a championship. So, I mean, I don't know how the contracts on this whole thing are working and what the support's going to be, but I feel like we've seen Matt DiBenedetto almost win in the Levine stuff, running much better. If you're going to ramp up the support even more and put Bell in the car, I don't see any reason why you can't expect to see some wins. And so I feel like it's going to be basically a fifth Joe Gibbs car, similar to what Furniture Row was. And with his abilities and that, again, that whole infrastructure wrapped around it, I don't see any reason why he's not going to be competing for wins. And the guy that needs to watch out, in all honesty, is Erik Jones. I mean, because Erik Jones has been there for a while, and yeah, he's got a win, but hasn't won at the level that the other drivers have. And we saw Suarez not win at that level and end up moving on. And I feel like there's going to be a, whether it's real or implied, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Erik Jones once Christopher Bell gets to the cup level.
So I agree with you, but I got to be honest, Neff, I still think Erik Jones is also incredible talent. He's going to get a ton of wins in the Cup Series. I truly believe that. But I also thought this is his third full-time year now. He has one win. I thought, you know, going back to 2016 in the Xfinity Series, he was the Christopher Bell. No, he didn't win the championship, but neither did Christopher Bell last year. But he got like 3 or 4 wins in back-to-back years. And yeah, maybe not as much as Bell, but also the series was more stacked. And then, he gets put into the 77 Furniture Row in 2017. You know, boots Kenseth out at the beginning of 2018 out of the 20 car. And like you said, not a lot of success at the Cup level yet. He's consistent, runs top 5, top 10 a lot, but hasn't led a ton of laps and really hasn't won besides Daytona. So could this be a situation for Bell too going forward? Because, I mean, obviously you don't know, but I would put Bell and Jones similar categories in terms of talent.
I would too. I think the thing that I have said before, and I think is starting to turn for Jones, is his ability to communicate what he needs in the car and his ability to adjust to what he's got in the car. I've always felt that, or at least from my observation, that if the car is spot on, Erik can run with anybody. But if it's off a little bit, it really seems to hinder him, that he doesn't seem to be as good at adapting when the car's not perfect. Mm-hmm. And we've seen in this level, I mean, a tenth of an inch makes the car not perfect. And so things happen that throw the car off all the time, and you have to learn to deal with it. I feel like the difference for Bell is that he's very good at that adapting part. And, you know, we talk about it periodically about the dirt guys and their ability to search for lines and to make their cars work in different spots because of their abilities that they've developed over the dirt racing. And I think that's I think that's the thing that's going to separate Bell from Jones. I think I'm with you. I think they're both talented, and I think they're both going to win a bunch of races. But the thing that I think is going to make Christopher that little bit better is his knowledge or his ability to feel out what his car is doing, feel out the racetrack, and figure out how to make his car perform the best in its current configuration for what the track has given him.
Good point. Good insight there. You look at Toyota, though, they only have 5 seats at the cup level, you know, 5 elite seats, and they got a ton of talent coming up. Something's got to give. So, yeah, like you said, Jones might be on the hot seat still going forward, but I feel like everyone is, because also, you know, the other drivers, Truex, Hamlin, Kyle, they're all getting older in age. I'm not saying any of them are going to retire anytime soon, but you never know. Andrew Luck shocked us over the weekend, so you never know. Neff, I do want to talk about Austin Cindric a little bit. I brought up how he came from 20th to 2nd.
I hate they didn't show more of that on TV.
It was like a video game.
You really didn't see it.
No.
And all of a sudden he was in 5th. And I'm like, how come we didn't see him carving through for that? Because we knew he started way back, and they never really showed it, and then all of a sudden he was top 5, and I'm like, dang, I would have loved to have seen him coming from the back.
Yeah, and he only finished, I think, 1.8 seconds off the lead. And also, you got to remember, on that final restart, and remember this too, Road America is a huge course, four miles in length. So, like you said earlier, the racing was good, especially when, you know, it tends to get strung out here, and it definitely could or should, because it's so damn big. But he came from 20th to 2nd in 2 laps. And then you had that Allmendinger mishap with Noah Gragson, and you had all these, Allmendinger had 2 mishaps on the final restart. And, you know, Cindric had to avoid all that, still got to 2nd. Had he not had to avoid any of that, I think he probably would have won the race.
I don't know about that yet.
I mean, 1.8 seconds. Coming, yeah, he was coming.
But I don't think he was close enough. Now, granted, if it went one more lap, absolutely. I don't think there's any question he'd have got him in another lap. But I feel like he was still, even being a little dodgy around some off tracks there on that last lap, I don't know that he was going to be up there for the win. But still, 20th to 2nd is, because the other thing was that he benefited from DiBenedetto sliding off. Because if DiBenedetto doesn't slide off, you know, if they go another lap, I don't think DiBenedetto pushes it quite as hard. It probably doesn't slide off, and he's got to work a lot harder to get around him. So things change. But, yeah, I mean, it was an amazing run to come in and get those tires that late. You were looking at it as it was unfolding going, this is the worst strategy ever, and he's going to finish like 15th. And then, like I said, you didn't see where it came from, but he ended up blasting all the way through, which is what we want to see. How many times do we have to say it? We want to see tires make a difference. And tires made a difference at Road America. It was awesome.
Yeah. DiBenedetto said on the download that it's kind of become like Homestead at that track, which I think that was the first time he's ever ran there. He may have ran there back in the day a few times. But, I thought it was an entertaining race all around. But Cindric put on a show. It was video game-esque. Doing that, coming from 20th to 2nd in such a short amount of time. I don't know. I think he truly would have won had he not had to avoid all that, because that's going to slow you up, obviously. 1.8 seconds isn't that much time. Coming from 20th to 2nd, I mean, he probably had to gain 5 seconds just to begin with, and then to miss all that other, you know, stuff. Impressive performance from Cindric. And Neff, ironic that we've had 3 road courses so far in the Xfinity Series. Bell and Cindric have finished 1-2 in all 3 of them.
Yeah.
So they good road racers.
They have been the road racing dudes. Now let's see if Cindric, and we know this, we've had Corey LaJoie on the tablet before, that, you know, it's ovals that are his downfall. And let's see if he can continue to mature and continue to advance his career on ovals to where he can legitimately become a title contender.
For sure. I do want to give a shout out to Kaz Grahlenef. You picked him last week.
Holla for Grahlenef, he was coming.
Finished 5th, his best result of the year for Richard Childress Racing, an unlimited opportunity. Neff, Jeremy Clements, former guest of the podcast, finished 8th. First time in his career he's had back-to-back top 10 finishes. And obviously, you know, I talked to him at Watkins Glen right before the Watkins Glen race. So the first race of the month. And he's like, he was so excited for this month of racing, because you got three road courses, which gives the little teams a shot, like his. You had Bristol, where he finished fourth, and then you have Darlington, which is obviously their home track. So, and he's run well there, too. So, you know, he's definitely made the most of this month, finishing no worse than 11th in the four races so far. Really good performance by that team because, I mean, they have three full-time employees. And, you know, they're 14th in points, have really no shot of making the playoffs unless they win, as does really nobody in the Xfinity Series outside the top 12. But what are your thoughts on Jeremy?
Yeah, Clemens is another one of those guys that, I mean, it's almost Landon Castle-esque. You know, you don't know, or you don't view him as being one of those guys that if he got in a great ride, he'd run for championships. But he's one of those guys, you give him a car, he's going to bring the car home in one piece, and he's going to get the most he can get out of the car without overstepping his bounds. And with teams like theirs, that's what they need. Their car's got to stay in pieces, or stay in one piece, and be able to go race to race. And so, I mean, he's talented. I don't know that he's championship talented, but I mean, he's a great personality. I don't think we get to see enough of that. And I think that he does a great job for what he's asked to do. And he's one of those guys that gets, like I said, gets the most out of the car without pushing it beyond its bounds.
Yeah, he's very blunt, and that is a good personality trait in NASCAR. I don't know. I kind of disagree with you on the whole championship talent, I guess, level for him, because we've never seen him in anything close to that. He's only ran his own equipment. If he got into, like, a Penske car, which was rumored back in the day, he's told me, or was almost a done deal just for a race to fill in for the 22 and 2016 at Kentucky, which was an Xfinity-only event. Instead, they had Ryan Blaney come down because he'd missed the playoffs in the cup level. But if he got an opportunity like that, I think he's definitely going to have, like, a Ross Chastain moment where he makes the most of it, like Ross did last year with Ganassi. And then we'll see what he really has, because...
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see it happen.
No, for sure.
I would really like to see one of those deals where he gets a shot in the 18 or in the 22, like you said, or the 12, you know, something where he gets to do a one-off or four or five races in a high-caliber car, and let's see what he's got. I'm with you. I would be curious, because, like I said, I think he's got good talent. I don't know that he's got great talent. But, like you said, we've never seen it, so we don't know.
For sure. I do want to give a shout-out also to Allgaier, Justin Allgaier, Cole Custer, who had, you know, looked to be terrible days. Allgaier had another flat tire, which, you know, he locked up the brakes, and that thing just blew. And it was quite a bit of smoke just for a flat tire. Got stuck in the gravel, went a lap down. His bad luck continues, but rebounded in ninth. And then Cole Custer went sign hunting, Neff. And and then he came back to finish 10th. So, I mean, those are good team days for those teams, you know, leading into the playoffs when you're going to have, you know, probably some trouble, like maybe not like this, but you're going to have to overcome some adversity in hopes of winning the championship.
Yeah, and then I give a credit to the Custer team, too, because they had to make multiple pit stops and remove some stuff and add some stuff and were out there in a car that was not aerodynamically ideal, which, like it or not, there's some pretty high speed sections on Road America, so you've gotta have good aero there. And for what they went through, I thought it was an outstanding effort for them.
For sure. All right, now if you want to move on some trucking.
Let's go trucking.
Yeah, let's go. All right, so Brett Moffitt put on a show, Neff, at there in Canada, Motorsport. I thought it was an entertaining race, I guess besides Moffitt, because he kind of ran away with the show. Now, he didn't win stage two because he, you know, pitted before the stage ended and put himself in better position for the final stage, which then he won by 5 seconds. So, you know, good run for him. He's won four straight playoff races in the Truck Series, Neff, dating back to Phoenix of last year. So this team's really, you know, obviously two different teams between the four wins, but the 24 team's hitting its stride right now, winning the past two races.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Ross put on a bit of a show, too.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen it pan out a little different to have those two go after it at the end. I think it would have been a great show. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, it was Moffitt's playground, and everybody else was trying to find a nut. you're right. That team and Moffitt as a driver are both peaking at the right time to be hitting on all cylinders when they need it the most. They had a flawless race, I thought. I didn't see anything that they did that was not expected. They didn't have any adversity to have to deal with. He kept the car on course. I mean, that's what you want to do to have a good day. And yeah, what was the final margin? Like 6.5 seconds or something?
5.1.
It was big. I know that. And he was just cruising over the last 3 or 4 laps, not really pushing it at all. Had he needed it, I think he had even more speed in it than he showed. So it was a clinic. And there's no doubt that, you know, a lot of people were trying to crown Chastain champion in this series before they even started the playoffs. And Moffitt has proven that you're going to go through the 24 if you want to get it.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, he won the first stage by 15 seconds. So that's tough to do in only, you know, 20 laps around what it takes like a minute and 20 to get around that road course. So, yeah, I thought he had a lot more. I know he was cruising towards the end in case they had a caution. They were good for one green, white checkered, and it turns out they didn't have a caution, so he didn't really need to save. But regardless, still won by 5 seconds and change. I do agree with you. I thought Ross put on a bit of a show, but Neff, it looked to me anyway, so hard to pass there. It looked like there was only a couple passing zones. You know, Ross would get up to like 4th or 5th and then just get stuck behind cars or trucks, I should say. And you know, only finished 8th. So, you know, and this truck battle right now is so close between 3rd and 7th, even 8th, I guess you could say, but only 6 points separate, Friesen and 3rd to Sauter in 7th.
And how about our boy Sauter dumping his teammate?
Yeah.
That was kind of not nice.
And Enfinger, I mean, you know, he needs every point he can get, you know. Yep. Granted, he won the regular season championship, but right now he's on the bubble and only a couple points to the good.
Yeah, that competition meeting yesterday had to be pretty interesting over at ThorSport. again, I feel like it's right now, it seems like it's the 24 and a 45 and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
ThorSport is there, but it just seems like they're a tick off. But again, it's road course racing, and Johnny Sauter is not some kind of road course expert. We all know that. So we get to ovals now. Let's see how things pan out. And what do we got? Like 2.5 months before they race again anyway. So we got time to get our trucks all cleaned up and shined up and ready to go racing and make some adjustments on them. But it's months of racing are dynamic and things come and go and ebb and flow. So we'll see what happens when we get down to the last 2 or 3 races as to whether, you know, the 24 and 45 are really the ones, because momentum is a big deal in racing. And when they get to Martinsville that Sauter's going to be in the mix and Enfinger's going to be in the mix, and a win there could go a long way towards a push to the final. So I'm cautiously optimistic right now that it's the 24 to 45, but it's at this point, it's still most of the people that are in the playoffs have a shot.
For sure. Yeah, I do want to talk about the schedule here in a minute and how kind of atrocious it is for, you know, because like you said, you know, not 2.5 months, but 2 months until the next round's over and on that, you know, 3 races per round. So, Neff, I want to mention, you know, you mentioned Sauter. That was his best finish since he won at Dover in May. The 6th place finish. That's shocking to me. You know, they've had a terrible year. Yeah, they've had a terrible year in terms of luck and then, you know, just things going wrong and out of their control. And then obviously you got the 1 race suspension. But yeah, 6th place finish. It's his best finish in 12 races. Just crazy for a former champion.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, he won't admit to it. Nobody in the team will admit to it, but that whole thing with Austin Hill, you know, you don't want to call it mojo, but messed with their chemistry.
Yeah.
Or messed with their momentum. And, you know, taking a week off in this sport is killer. And I really feel like they are still struggling to rebound from that. And with this schedule, as you talked about us getting ready to look at it, it's going to take a little bit to get that momentum going because of the fits and starts that you have going through this schedule with these big gaps.
Yeah. So I want one more topic before we get to the schedule. So you think it's between the 24 and 45. I do too. Now, the 45 Nice Motorsports gets their chassis from GMS, as does the 52 team with Stuart Friesen. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but do you feel like they could be not giving them bad chassis, but just giving and preparing the 24 team's chassis a little bit more and better, because obviously that's in-house and, you know, they want to win another championship?
It's easy from the outside looking in to say that could happen. But in all honesty, a lease program like that is dependent on you giving your customers the best that you can give them. And if they turn around and even have the implication that there is, you know, that there's favoritism or that there's a difference in quality, it could destroy their business. And let's face it, in trucks, you need all sorts of income to make these things go. So if they stepped on it to where nobody wanted to lease their chassis because of the implied idea that if you make it to the playoffs, you're going to get subpar equipment, I don't think that from a business standpoint, they're going to let that happen. It's easy to say it on the outside looking in because we like to be conspiracy theorists, but in reality, for GMS's business model, they cannot afford to not give the best or equal equipment to their customers.
And I guess I only bring that up because I think back to Kentucky when NASCAR confiscated Friesen's truck before it even hit the track. And that was something on the interior. I forget exactly what it was. It was something with the rear firewall, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it was classified as rear firewall, but what it ultimately was they had modify the truck somehow so that the truck arms that come from the front to the back and hold the rear housing in place had the ability to travel further than normal. Mm. And they had made like almost a tunnel on the inside of the truck next to the driver so that the right side truck arm had more room to travel, which was going to, you know, obviously allow you to load the right side up more when you're going around an oval and give you more drive off. So that was one of those deals. I don't know what you feel like. There had to be discussion between GMS and Friesen's team because as soon as I saw a picture of it, I'm like, that didn't even look right. And that's where I was like, so they had to, even before they tried to roll it through tech, had to know that something was funky, which makes me feel like they had to know when it came from GMS what GMS was trying, and whether they had discussions about, okay, we'll try to run it through instead of you guys try to run it through or whatever. But it was a brand new chassis they'd never used before, and obviously they don't use it now. I feel like there had to be some knowledge on Friesen's team that was happening before they ever got to the racetrack.
Yeah, it'd definitely be interesting to know in the inner shop because – you know, post-race, Friesen finished second, and he told me, I asked him straight up, what's this mean was this kind of a building day? What's it say about your team at Hallmar? Because they had to overcome so much, start in the rear, and then they really had they were out to lunch for most of the night, and then they ended up finishing second. And he's like, well, I don't know, I know what it says about our team, but I don't know what it says about the other team, and the other team being GMS. So right. I'm curious about the inner workings there, but that's the only reason I bring that up because, the 24 and the 45 right now are probably the favorites. And you could probably put Friesen right there too, a little bit behind him, but he's running third in points. So that means GMS or its affiliates are 1-3. But let's talk about the schedule, shall we?
Sure. I'm actually sitting here looking at it right now.
I am too. So
one race in the better part of a month.
Yeah. So this is what kills me, right? Since Pocono, which was 4 weeks ago, they had five races. They ran at Pocono, Eldora, Michigan, Bristol, and then this past weekend on the road course in Canada. So in 29 days, between July 27th and August 25th, they ran five races in 29 days. Now, there's five races left in the year now. There's, you know, only five races to go. And that spanned out over 82 days from the checkered flag on Sunday.
Yep.
That's ridiculous. And, you know, last year on this week of the podcast, you know, Justin Haley won the race in Canada, came on the podcast. We ran it about the schedule and kind of like you can't get any momentum. You know, Moffitt's got all this momentum, but now he's got 3 weeks off before we get to Las Vegas. And then we got another 4 weeks off before we get to Talladega. And then another 2 weeks off before we get to Martinsville. And then, oh yeah, another 2 weeks off. And then finally Homestead. So, I mean, this is ridiculous in my opinion. Like,
we've talked about this for years too. Yeah. Because it's actually better at the beginning now than it used to be.
Yeah.
But the beginning is still jacked up too. I mean, you went February 15th to March 29th. So a little over a month and ran five races. And then you took a month and a half off. You go from March 29th till May 3rd without running a race. And people forget the series even exists when you go that long.
Seriously, yeah.
And it just, it seems to me, and you know, I'm the old get off my lawn guy, but it seems like we've got to get back to what this series was originally established for and get it away from the mile and a half tracks and away from the companion events and get them back to running Irwindale and Evergreen and Raceway Park and South Boston and Hickory and hell, run them at Thompson or Stafford or something like that. Tracks that are small, you know, short tracks that allow local guys to maybe come in and compete and get away from live pit stops, have breaks, and make your adjustments in so that we're not having to pay live pit crews so we don't have that expense. Because that's a huge expense. When you get a cup-level team to pit your truck, five guys going over the wall, I realize that they cut a break because they're usually at the track anyway, but if it's a standalone event, they're not, and you're paying the full load to get a cup-level team in there. And most of those guys make $3,000 or $4,000 on a weekend. So for a given race, they're making $1,000 a piece, give or take, on the good teams. So you're spending $5,000 just on your pit crew if you're doing live pit stops, where if you're doing breaks, you don't need that kind of ability. And you can just have the guys that normally work on your vehicle change the tires and gas it up and get it ready to go because you have a 5 minute or 10 minute break between segments of a race. And that's, if we're looking at ways to cut cost and we're looking at ways to re-engage fans and to re-identify a series, that's what we need to do with the trucks. We need to get them back away from the big tracks. We need to get them back to the local tracks, standalone events. We need to get away from live pit stops and have them go back to breaks between segments in a race.
Yeah, I mean, and the Truck Series have never had more than, 27 races in a year, and that's 1998, so one of the first years of existence. It had 20 its first year in existence. So, you know, we have 23 now, but you look at all these breaks, it's like, you know, the Xfinity Series has 33, Cup has 36, and the Xfinity Series have, you know, they're on a 15-week stretch of racing right now in a row, which is, you know, that kills the teams, and especially if you're a smaller team. But the Truck Series, I mean, this is the longest stretch of racing of the year, what we just had, the 5 weeks in a row. And it's just, I don't know, do we need more, like, is more races a solution? Or do they need to be spread out better? I don't know.
That's the key. They need to be spread out better, and you can do that if you're not in companion races with the National Series.
Right.
I understand that if we go to that, we're probably going to get away from live race coverage, at least at some of the events. Because, again, live race coverage of a race is $250,000 or more to make that happen. And, I mean, that's just a lot of money for, you know, for a series that is not you know, infused with cash like the Cup Series is. So you gotta accept that we will be watching on Fans Choice, or we'll be watching a stream, or maybe a pay-per-view to help boost the series. And I'm okay with that. Because of the fact that it gets us back to racetracks where we should be running instead of on these bigger tracks.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
That's right. I just went back to the 27 races that you were talking about in 98. And we were on a couple big tracks. We ran at Homestead, ran at Texas, finished the year at Vegas, and ran Fontana even. So we were on a two-mile track. But the rest of the schedule is road courses or mile or less tracks. And that is what the series was built on, and that's what they need to get back to.
I agree. And it's confusing, right? Because their playoff started at Bristol. Last year it started this past weekend at the road course. But they took Texas out and moved the fall Texas race at the beginning of the year. And they have two Texas races every year, so that they were both in the first 3 months of the year or whatever, until the beginning in June. That took a week away later in the season, but it's so confusing. And I have casual fans come up to me all the time, like, oh, NASCAR is a playoffs. They start talking about NASCAR. A lot of them don't know that NASCAR even has a playoff system, which is, kind of sad. But also, you dig into it, and it's so hard to explain, and especially if you go down the ranks. Like, the trucks playoffs, it's just as long, right? Well, it's seven races, but it's just as long, and it's longer in terms of dates, like, from the middle of August all the way to the end of November. But there's three less races, and on top of that, there's really, eight less races or so, because the Cup Series is still going.
Right.
In a perfect world, this isn't just my opinion, I feel like all the playoff races should line up together. If you're gonna do the top three series traveling, all ending at Homestead.
And I'm not on board with that.
Really?
Because again, I don't want to see the trucks and companion events. So it would be cool if I'm with them running the same weekends and having the last 8 weeks of the season be the playoffs, or the last 10 weeks of the season be the playoffs, however the trucks are going to do it. But I don't know that I necessarily want them running the same tracks. So, and to just throw out, I don't know, some kind of an example, if Cup's running at Texas, maybe we have, I'm trying to think of a local asphalt track in Texas, and I got nothing coming up on top of my head. Everything I know of down there is dirt. I mean, let's say they put Indy in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
They run
IRP.
Cup at the big track, they run the trucks at IRP. If we go to California, let's say in the playoffs, run Cup at Fontana, run the trucks at Irwindale. So you're in the same region of the country, but you're running the trucks on a local short track. I mean, do Vegas. They run the trucks. They run a Cup at the mile and a half, and they run the trucks on the Bullring. That would be a perfect scenario, So it's, I feel like the possibility's there to have it mirror up weekend wise, but I still feel like I want to see the trucks get away from the big tracks, because when you get back to local short tracks, you take away at least some of the expense. Looking at local late model racing, the expense in late model racing is skyrocketed, and it's in a very elite kind of thing these days. So there's still expense to it, but not at the level that you've got in trucks that you have to run on these big tracks. And I think if you get back to short tracks where aero is not king, you're going to save these teams a bunch of money.
I agree with you on that. I guess that's more of what I meant. You should have them in. I feel like the schedule should line up, whether it's dates, tracks, whatever.
Right.
Only because.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Only because it's so much. I don't want to say confusing, because we should know, and we do know, like, what the schedule is, but.
Well, we do, but a ca- casual fan.
Exactly. And they're like, oh, this is the playoffs. Like, it's, I don't want to say it's hard to take seriously, the Truck Series, because it's a great series. And I think we got Truck Series lifers there. Obviously, Matt Kraft and Johnny Sauter. Brett Moffitt might be turning into a Truck Series lifer, even though he's got a ton of talent and could probably run at the, in the front of the field at the cup level, if given the opportunity. But I don't, it's just so, the Truck Series, it's not hard to take seriously, but it just needs, it needs something, whether it's going back to the short tracks, like, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, or maybe it is adding a few more races, but spreading them out throughout the schedule and kind of filling in the gaps of, you know, like, you know, one race in the next 5 weeks or whatever is just uncalled for.
Yep, I agree. And it's, and I think Eldora is a perfect example. Eldora is unique to the trucks, and I love that. I really, as much as I know people have talked about wanting to see Cup go back to dirt, and I personally would love to see it, I don't want to see it at Eldora. I want to see them go to DuCoin or Springfield, one of these big mile dirt tracks, so that it's more like ARCA runs. And,
right,
you know, I just... The Eldora race is unique to the trucks, and it needs to stay that way. And that's where I want the trucks to have their own identity. I feel like one of the things that I feel like we've lost, and I don't know that we could get it back, although we potentially could, again, if we make trucks their own unique animals on short tracks, is the ability of a local star to compete against the national racers. Back when Busch was Busch, and you had Sam Ard and Dick Trickle and Jack Ingram going and running at South Boston and Orange County and tracks like that, there would be local guys that would come and race against them. And the rules allowed for that, that your local car could pass the rules and contend at the Grand National level. And that was a huge deal, because your local star could compete with these national stars, and it just, it was a great draw for the fans, and it was a great opportunity for a local star to showcase his talents in front of these other teams. And I feel like that's one thing that I would love to see us get back to, because even K&N at this point in time, a K&N car is so specialized that somebody can't take a late model and run a K&N race. You have to have a K&N car. And you just don't have the opportunity for a local driver to go and run that race. And I really feel like if we got trucks to be their own standalone thing, and we made the rules to where local contenders could throw a truck together or get a truck and put it together for a reasonable amount of money, I think that would build a following for the trucks. And I think it would also help build the NASCAR fan base, because you would end up drawing in local drivers to compete against the national guys.
Yeah, it'd almost be like a push towards the grassroots racing, which NBC's pushing right now, you know, very heavily. So,
can I say one thing about that? I love, I'm a short track guy, and I love local racing, but can we please move the sign out to the grandstands? I'm tired of seeing victory lane shots for this grassroots thing. I'm like, yeah, it's cool that these are the guys winning, but let's get the fans in this. I want to see fans in the stands taking their picture next to the sign. Every shot they show us is guys in victory lane. And I know these guys, or I've seen these guys. I want to see some fan shots. I want them to move the sign into the stands.
Fair point. I do think it's at least a good thing that they are promoting it, for sure, when in the past, you know, no one really has. At least at the level NBC is doing. On State Street in Bristol 2 weeks ago now, which State Street's the street that separates Tennessee from Virginia, they have a big event on Wednesday night before the Bristol Night Race every year. And this year, you know, I've gone the past 2 years because it's only 2 years I've been to Bristol, but this year was packed with people and events. And, you know, of those events, there's local, you know, short track racers, whether it's dirt or pavement or whatever, that had, like, you know, their cars on display, and it had, NBC was there promoting it, the grassroots racing, which was really cool. But maybe we can get the Truck Series kind of back to that. Like you said, in terms of, like, you know, local drivers coming in, that's kind of what Eldora does. they maybe not be local, but they're local to dirt racing. And, you know, whether it's like the Kyle Stricklers of the world or whoever, the Marlar, whatever his name is, from that race with the Ream brothers this year and finished fourth. I mean, you know, that's a hell of a drive for him, hell of a finish for that team, and something that they need. And I don't know, I feel like that's what this needs to get back down to. Whether that's, like you said, you know, we race at Fontana, go to Irwindale with the trucks or whatever, Vegas, the Bullring. You know, pair these, I still think we should pair these tracks up because it will cut costs overall.
I'm with you. And then, again, if you get it like that, maybe showing the show on TV is still possible because the equipment is in the general area. And, yeah, we don't get a full-blown broadcast like we get at the cup level, but we can have two or three cameras and a pit reporter, you know, and maybe the one announcer goes instead of a full-blown booth. But the potential is there for us to really build the sport and build the fan base by getting back to these local racetracks and just be different from the national levels. I mean, I blame this all on David Huth, although in reality we had raced my own ass before that, but David Huth was the guy that ran the Truck Series when they ran at Daytona. And I still feel like the Truck Series went dramatically downhill once they ran at Daytona and they realized they could put on shows on these big tracks. And I wish we'd just completely get away from that. It's interesting, actually, looking through this schedule from 98 with the Craftsman trucks and how many racetracks don't exist anymore. And it's really kind of depressing.
Yeah.
They ran at Disney, which I'm pretty sure doesn't exist anymore. Portland, that was not the road course. I don't believe that track exists anymore. They ran at I-70, which I believe still exists but is dirt now. Ran at Nazareth, which doesn't exist anymore. Pikes Peak, I'm still confused on Pikes Peak. I think it's still there, but I don't know that anybody uses it. Flemington, which I believe is closed. Nashville, the bigger track at Nashville, which is now closed, or is still there, but I don't know if they're using it. Louisville, which was demolished when they built Kentucky. What else we got? There was one. Mesa Marin is the other one, which was an iconic track and is now closed. So you've got, you know, six or eight tracks that don't even exist anymore. That's kind of depressing.
Yeah, that is depressing. I can concur that Nazareth is no longer in existence. I've been to that track, seen it since its kind of demise, I guess you could say, about a decade and a half ago or whenever it was. Kind of sad what happens to all these tracks. It just, they let, you know, the local government or whoever it is just doesn't take control of it, and it just, you couldn't even tell it's a racetrack anymore. So,
yep.
Kind of sad, but moving on now, we're going to stick with the Truck Series, but kind of interesting news, I guess you could say, and kind of depressing news if you're Tyler Dipple. So on, you know, over the weekend, I guess Friday, right before the truckers got to Canada, I like how we call them truckers. So they're going to Canada, and, you know, it's announced that he won't be going, that he was suspended by NASCAR. You know, the details were very vague from NASCAR. Obviously from Dipple's camp and from Young Motorsports. So, on Sunday, this, and I think this did have to be covered on race day for the trucks. I do think it had to, but maybe brush over it only because the details weren't out. Right. So, you know, Todd O'Dine, Jeff Hammond, come on, you know, good analysts. But Todd O'Dine kind of goes off, and I thought his words were kind of harsh because nobody knew the details, saying that, you know, this is his third strike. Well, if it's his third strike, what were the other two? And you know, if you're in our Slack channel at Front Stretch, we can only think of, at the very most, the incident with Ben Rhodes at Eldora. And that was just a fight. I mean, that'd be pretty hypocritical for NASCAR to consider that a strike. So it turns out, you know, first, what are your thoughts on kind of the Fox Sports Group going off or giving their thoughts on something, you know, details that the public didn't know?
I mean, that's part of what we expect from our national coverage folks, is that they are on the inside. That's kind of why we have them in the positions they're in. so that they can give us insight and things that they know that we don't know. But you've dealt with sources before, and then you've got to kind of do a balancing act of what you can disclose and what you can't disclose. But I'm with you. I felt like there should have been a little more explanation of the other strikes because, as you said, we've not heard that there were other strikes. So it would have been nice to know. I have since read something that one of them was a speeding ticket.
Yeah, we'll get in detail.
Which, you know, it's, yes, when you're a National Series driver, speeding tickets are not good. They put a black eye on the sport. I don't know that it's as bad as bump drafting on the interstate, which is the famous story that we've all heard of Richard Petty going up 85, bump drafting somebody in the fast lane on I-85 way back when. So it's happened to the best of them. But at the same time, I appreciated it from the fact of who it was coming from, and especially Bodine, because Bodine is, and you mentioned earlier, a lifer in trucks. Yeah, Bodine's run some Xfinity races and run some Cup races, I believe. I know he ran Xfinity. But he made his hay in trucks, and trucks hold a very special place for him. And he's looking at it, I think, through eyes of you don't necessarily get another shot, or you don't know when your next opportunity is going to come. So when you've got an opportunity, don't screw it up. And I think he's mostly disappointed or upset that Dipple has this chance and he's screwing it up because either he doesn't have the right people in his corner, like slapping him around, telling him he's screwing it up, or he's got people that are enabling him and you know, kind of like, oh, it's okay, honey, they're just picking on you, that kind of thing. So I appreciate that it was brutally honest. I would have liked a little more detail on what the strikes were, but I thought it was genuine from the heart analysis because of the fact, like I said, that Dipple's got a chance here, and he's screwing it up because either he and or his people are not, you know, whipping him into shape when he does screw up.
And plus, you know, obviously Tyler Dipple's the center of attention because he's the driver, but all of the people that his decisions affect, whether it's...
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that with Levine.
Yeah.
You know, that everybody's railing on Bob about making a driver decision. There's 30 other employees there that he's got that are dependent on paychecks from him. And when he makes that decision, he's got to weigh everybody, not just the fans of a given driver.
Right. So I agree with you on most of the Bodine stuff and Jeff Hammond, but it was more so Bodine that was kind of outspoken. I wish we would have known the strikes or at least a little more info. I do agree, like, you know, you can only reveal so much with sourcing, but I don't know. I feel like it needed... Because nobody, if you were just a casual fan watching this race, you're like, what the hell's going on? Yep. What happened? But since, you know, since Sunday, we have gotten some details, so I'll read them off. On Monday, Alan Kavan and Bob Pockris, you know, Alan, obviously the pit reporter for Fox Sports, does a great job with that. But on Monday, he said he got, you know, he contacted New York State Police, and they charged Tyler Dipple with criminal possession of a controlled substance, seventh degree, on August 18th in his hometown of Wallkill, New York, which, for those of you that don't know, geographically, is out towards, you know, Orange County Speedway, another short track, dirt track, out towards, like, kind of towards New York City, out that way, Orange County. So that's a Class A misdemeanor. And then troopers say Dipple was traveling in excess of 80 miles per hour when he was pulled over, and that Dipple had a passenger in his car, but they both had different stories on where they were coming from and where they were going. And then troopers said, you know, told Kavana that they gave Dipple that Dipple gave them verbal consent to search the vehicle. So when the troopers searched the vehicle, I might butcher these names because I'm really terrible at names like this, but they found amphetamine and dextroamphetamine in a pill bottle inside a backpack, and they were prescribed to someone else. So not even prescribed to Dipple. The two drugs cited by the trooper are what is commonly found in Adderall. Now, we've seen instances of drivers get suspended for, you know, taking Adderall or something similar in the past. So his court date's Wednesday the 28th, which is, you know, we're recording this Tuesday morning, so it's tomorrow. And in a statement that Young's Motorsports gave, it's an ongoing investigation and they don't really have any more comments. So, Neff, with all of this, you know, and, you know, you brought up the speeding ticket. He was charged with a misdemeanor of reckless driving in Virginia during a race weekend in March. So I'm guessing that was Martinsville weekend, according to online Corn Records, that was one of the strikes. So there's still a second strike out there that nobody really knows about. But now that we have all these details, what are your thoughts?
I think he's screwing up. And it's disturbing that he had a bottle that was prescribed to somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's one of, I think that's the part that's unsettling about it. Because you're wondering why. You know, is he, and I don't know Adderall. I have heard from people that if you don't need it, that it gives you heightened focus and it just kind of makes you ultra hyperly intense and able to really focus. If it's not, you know, it's because it's for ADHD. And I've never tried it. I've never been exposed to it, so I don't know from a personal experience. But that is, of people that I know who have taken it recreationally, that is their reason for doing it, because it put them at a whole different level of concentration. And I think that may be why we hear of athletes taking it, because it gives them that ability to focus even more. But it's disturbing that it was prescribed to somebody else. So you're like, did he buy it from them?
Yeah.
Did he steal it from them? How did he come into the possession of this? And that's the thing that I'd really kind of like to hear. But at the same time, it's just dumb. God, it's so dumb. And that's the part that's frustrating about it, is we constantly are talking about the opportunities to race at the national level and how special and rare they are. And this is a young man with some talent that needs to be focused or pointed in the right direction. And it kind of seems like the people around him are not even doing that. And that's the kind of disappointing thing on it, that as soon as he had the first strike, whatever that was, somebody needed to sit down and have a talk with the young man. And it feels like, and maybe they have, and maybe it hasn't sunk in, you know? I mean, we've seen that with people in the past in our sport that have screwed up multiple times, and eventually it goes really south. So hopefully, keeping the fingers crossed for him. I was trying to remember a name, and it just popped into my head. Tyler Walker was one of those guys, you know, that screwed up a lot. A lot of people tried to talk to him and set him straight, and it never sunk in, and was a really intense, great talent that we never got to see fully blossom because of that. So I'm hoping this is a big wake-up call. I wonder, will Young Motorsports give him another shot? Or is this going to be something, I mean, because we saw it with Allmendinger. Remember when Allmendinger got booted out of Penske, it was a while before he got another shot at that level of equipment. So I'm hoping, for his sake, that he does the road to recovery thing. And again, I don't know if there is road to recovery on this, because it wasn't a drug violation. It's a code of conduct thing. So I don't know what the steps are to be reinstated. I'm curious how that's something that we probably need to research a little bit on, because I don't know the steps of recovery from that, because when it's an indefinite suspension like that, it's kind of like at NASCAR's discretion when they reinstate him. And I don't know that there's a prescribed path like there is when you have a drug violation. So we'll see, but for the young man's sake, I hope this is a wake-up call, and he gets his act together, because you hate to see somebody with a talent that is that young throw it away, because, I mean, if he ultimately ends up not getting back in, what's he going to do? You know, I don't know that he's got a degree as a lawyer or something, so I'm thinking he needs to get his act together, or he's going to have to go get a real job flipping burgers.
Yeah, I mean, he's this is no excuse at all, but he's 19 years old, right? And he's, you know, we think of 19-year-olds, and we just think of immaturity. We think, you know, he's still a teenager. So, you know, I don't expect stuff like this to happen, especially when you have the people around you that you do, you know, at the NASCAR level. You're racing for a national, in the National Touring Series. And you know, I've watched this kid grow up. You know, he's races dirt modifieds around the Northeast, Wheatsport Speedway, my home track. I've seen him race tons of times there, ton of times at other tracks in the area. And he does have a lot of talent. Finished second in the K&N East Points last year to Tyler Ankrum. Had a race win last year, and then also three years ago now. So I do think he has a ton of talent. Super young. But yeah, there's a court date, so it's a big deal. Because you don't know what the end result could be. You gotta make smarter decisions. You know, like you said you've never dealt with anything like that. Neither have I. I've never had a controlled substance anywhere near myself. And in college, like if I did, I told the people to get the hell out of my apartment. So you got to make smarter decisions, in my personal opinion.
Yep, absolutely.
So enough on Dipple. Hopefully he figures his act together. Wish Fox would have handled it a little bit better too, from my own standpoint. But Neff, another drug failure. Matt Borland, and we didn't talk much about Bailey Curry last week when he was suspended for failing a drug test. But Matt, this is interesting, and you and I were.
Yeah, and this is wild because it's Matt Borland.
Yeah,
I mean, talking about one of the most straight-laced dudes in the garage. That's what that really cracked me up about this one.
So he got chemical or an ingredient called DMAA in a diet coffee that he's drinking. DMAA is 2-amino-5-methylhexamine. I might have butchered that. Again, I apologize if I did. But that was found. That's the same ingredient or substance that was found in Bailey Curry's pre-workout that he was suspended for prior to Bristol. Now, this is diet coffee.
The problem with this one, too, is it's not listed on the label. According to what I read, anyway, the substance is not listed on the label. That you had to go to, like, the website and research it to find out that it was actually in the product.
I would love to know what this 2-amino-5-methylhexamine does to you. Because it sure seems to be getting a lot of people lately, or at least two in a week and a half or so. With Bailey Curry and his pre-workout, and then also Matt Borland, this, you know, on Monday morning. That was pretty shocking news I woke up to Monday morning. I don't really know what to say because, you know, I'll bring Curry up because, you know, he's ran a lot of races this year between the top three series, and he's been working hard on his cardiovascular endurance because he's running more miles than he ever has, you know, in a car or a truck standpoint. Finished sixth at Michigan with Nice Motorsports. He's done really well, I thought, in his opportunities, and also for Rick Ware, which, you know, you can only have certain expectations in one of those cars, let's be honest. And I think he's done pretty decent in them. And then you go to Borland, and diet coffee, Neff. Diet coffee. That's just so shocking that we're now getting drivers and, you know, crew members suspended for drinks and, you know, with a pre-workout and diet coffee, which... I mean, there's no harm. There's no harm being done, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, and again, you don't know. And this is where, and we had this discussion back with the Brian Vickers days, that you don't know for sure what all is in these energy drinks and in these different things that people are putting together now, because they throw all sorts of stuff in them. And it's designed to pick you up. It's designed to stimulate you. And once you get into trying to stimulate people and keep people awake, you get into stuff that can be crossing the line on the stimulant front. And I don't know how the list is compiled for NASCAR. Again, we don't have a union, so there's not a collectively bargained list of substances. This is something that NASCAR puts together a list. I'm sure they've paid some consultant an exorbitant amount of money to come up with this list, but they've got a list that they have put together, and that's what they enforce on. And there's no, again, without a union, you don't have a means of really adjusting that other than going with your driver council or whatever and saying, hey, can we lose this or add this or whatever. But in the end, it's NASCAR's call. And you are aware of what the list is. They give it to everybody before the season starts. And it's up to you to be responsible for what goes into your body. And that's where this really gets sketchy in the modern world, because there are so many of these different energy drinks and different diet drinks and just everything that's available that are designed as stimulation. And when you get to the level where you're throwing stuff at stimulation, they will hide different stuff in there to make it work better, because if it works better, you're going to sell more product. And so I think that's where whatever this substance is probably a very good ingredient to stimulate or awaken people. And that's where this is being put into these drinks. And unfortunately, it ended up on the list. So at this point in the off season, if people don't think it's a big deal, they're going to need to get some folks to go down to Daytona and lobby a little bit to get it taken off of the list, or you're going to have to be a lot more vigilant about what you put in your body.
Yeah, for sure. Good analysis there. But, you know, it's interesting because in a statement that he put out on, you know, through Germain Racing, he said, after the surprise of this and not even knowing what that was, I asked if it could have come from a diet coffee that I've been drinking for the past 6 months. So the 6 months kind of stands out, because if he's been taking this for 6 months, you know, drinking this diet coffee, does that mean he hasn't been drug tested in 6 months? And how often are we drug testing? And I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of kind of gray area.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. I mean, everybody gets tested before the season starts. And then from there on, they have random tests. And depending on, at least the way I understand it, depending on your history and what happens in your tests drives how frequently you get tested. So if you get tested and there's high levels of something, but it's not a violation, they're going to test you more often. If you test clean and there's nothing even questionable, they may get you once or twice during the season. But there's, as it's been explained to me, they test everybody before Daytona, and then during the year there are random tests, and obviously more for drivers than crew members, but they get crew members as well. And it's driven, frequency is driven by past results.
Yeah, so I can tell you it's random, and I don't know how much I should say. Probably shouldn't be saying this at all, honestly. But at Richmond in the spring in April, I was interviewing Ryan Sieg, and you know, a NASCAR official came up. We were doing the interview, and they just pulled him aside and said, "You got to get drug tested." And then I was, you know, we continued talking, and we didn't know how quickly that had to be. And NASCAR official comes back over like 5 minutes later, saying, "You got to do this in the next 5 minutes." And so, you know, he went off, we cut the interview short and then talked later, but it does seem very random. They just come up to you whenever they want. And
maybe, yeah, I mean, when it's time to be tested, you don't get advance warning.
Yeah.
You're literally at the track, and sometimes it's like between practice sessions and stuff. So it's not like,
yeah, that's what
it's
this
not
was.
Like they do it right when you get to the track. There can be different times during the weekend that they'll do it. I believe even sometimes after guys win, they test them a little more often, just again, because they don't want somebody that's the winner to have an advantage.
For sure. Yeah, that was between practice sessions, too, on a Friday. So, kind of interesting. But, Neff, any final thoughts on any of this before we move on to Darlington and, you know, pick our picks for this weekend, but also our favorite paint scheme of the weekend?
No, I think on this, I got one more thing to talk about, but I don't want to do that at the end. But, yeah, as far as trucks and and Xfinity. I thought it was a great weekend of racing. I give kudos to everybody, and it's, again, we didn't really even talk about it that much at Watkins Glen weekend, but it's why I think we should run the boot. I think we've gotten to the point where all drivers at most levels are competent enough at road course racing that we're ready to put them on some more technical road courses.
All right, so now moving into Darlington here. Throwback weekend, the annual throwback weekend. I think this is the fifth year. I guess we'll start with favorite paint scheme. We were kind of going through this beforehand. I'll be honest, I really like Paul Menard's, the 21 paint scheme, which is inspired by the 1957 Ford Sunliner raced by Wood Brother Racing's, you know, founder Glenn Wood, who obviously recently passed away. I like this paint scheme a lot, black and red. They run a throwback, like you said to me, you know, prior to the show, pretty much every week with the red, yeah. With the red and white. But this is cool. It's got a black, you know, kind of primary, and then a red on the sides, and also like a yellow stripe. And then the 21 is kind of what gets me, the font of it. So I really like that one. I know we talked about the Landon Castle one, which got announced earlier this week, which is a throwback to Sterling Marlin in the early 2000s, which is really cool. It's got the Rocky Mountains on the valence. And then, you know, it's sponsored by Starcom Fiber, not Coors Light, which would have been really cool. But, you know, as the Rocky Mountains, that one looks really cool. But I have to give the nod to Paul Menard's 21.
Yeah, I like the 21 a lot as well, and I'm with you. I love that it's different from their normal scheme because, as we said, they run a throwback about every weekend. And so it's cool that they went somewhere completely different. I like Austin Dillon's. Yep. From a visual perspective. I don't know that I'm that into the throwback of it, but just the visually, I think it's a beautiful race car. But my pick is going to be LaJoy's. The 32 going back to the Nestle Crunch back in the day, it's Corvette parts did it, but I just like the way that it looks. That it really pulls the Dale Jarrett Nestle Crunch out from way back, and it just, something about that car just really gets me going. McDowell's paint scheme is really cool, looking like Jimmy Mean's old Alka-Seltzer car. I thought that was really neat. I like Matt Tiff's. So much that it's really a throwback, but it's going to a dirt late model. I mean, the fact that we're branching out that much is really awesome. Kudos to the Stuart Haas folks for playing off all three of Tony's winning championship paint schemes is really cool. I kind of like Kyle Busch's look too. And it's a really different, a different look. And the fact that we're throwing back to Bobby Hillen. I mean, that's one of those things you don't really picture people throwing back to Bobby Hillen. So that's kind of a nice look. Hemric's Caterpillar car is interesting too. I mean, it's not really throwing back to a paint scheme per se. It's throwing back to just the original Caterpillar tractor, but it's also just kind of eye-catching. So that's kind of neat. I would have loved to see Newman actually drive a Wienermobile instead of his car, but something tells me that wouldn't get through the laser inspection.
Probably not. We also talked about Alex Bowman's off the record or, you know, before we recorded. And it's honoring Tim Richmond who won the 1986 Southern 500 for Rick Hendrick, ironically enough. And this is like it's like a dark reddish, almost kind of a maroonish color, and then like a gold number font, and then the valence and the splitters also goldish. I guess you call it goldish. If that's like a chromish color, that's going to look badass, I think, under the lights.
Yeah, it looks like the liquid chrome finish that you see come out of Lionel in action. And if it really is that, you better wear sunglasses when you're looking at it, because the sun is going to glare off of that thing.
For sure. All right, enough. So we talked about the throwback schemes. We got two races this weekend with the Xfinity and Cup Series. Let's start with the Xfinity Series, Neff. I'll give you my pick. It's kind of, I guess, sentimental because he only races once a year now. You don't think he's going to win, but I'll go Dale Jr. Why not? He's racing. He's racing a throwback scheme. To one of the Wrangler cars, right? Yep. And you know, it's a really nice scheme. I've seen in person at the Philadelphia Takeover. It was the first time they really displayed it to the public. Back in March or May. Super nice paint scheme. I'll go Dale Jr. You know, you got to remember, and obviously a different track, but last year he ran the one race at Richmond and he probably should have won the race, led the most laps, and finished fourth. So, you know, he's obviously got the most experience in the field. I'm going to go Dale Jr.
So, running at Richmond is okay with Jr. because he used to own Richmond. When he ran at DEI, they could be terrible anywhere else. They would still show up at Richmond and contend to win. He's god-awful at Darlington. So that's, I mean, you can go on out with, it'll be stunning if he wins at Darlington. I'll be almost surprised if he ends up on a lead lap because he's that bad there. In all reality, I think Denny Hamlin's going to win the race, but that's a cheesy pick, so I'm not going to go down that road, although I think he's your guy that's going to win. But, you know, looking at the list, and I had an idea, and then I changed my mind on my idea, and I'm thinking about going back on my mind. It's Christopher Bell.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, you can't. I think Tyler Reddick's going to be in the mix because Darlington running the rim is a way to go, and you know he's great at running the rim, but I can't go against Christopher Bell at Darlington. I just feel like he's going to walk.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if Tyler Reddick won. This is where he turned his season around last year, and then went on, you know, a playoff spurt, you know, this and led him to the championship. So this is where it started last year for him, and he's already got 20 top 10s this year, which matches last year's total. We still got 10 races to go. So wouldn't be surprised at all if the two ends up in victory lane. And enough cup racing. You think Hamlin's going to win for the Xfinity race? I wouldn't be shocked either. You know, we talk about Richmond being Junior's playground. Well, I feel like Darlington's Hamlin's. I'm going Denny Hamlin to win this race.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. I think Denny Hamlin's going to be the one to beat. As much as I really feel like Kyle Busch needs a win, I feel like that team has been in a bit of a funk, and I think they really need to win a race. I'm confident that he's going to win at Indy because he just owns that place right now. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say Kyle Larson. Larson has been
struggling this year.
But I feel like this is one of those tracks that could fall in Larson's wheelhouse. And the thing I worry about with Larson, as you do any week with him, is that he has that momentary lapse in concentration. And you know he's going to hit the wall because everybody hits the wall at Darlington, but it's a matter of how hard. And it invariably seems like Larson has that one moment every race where he bounces it off the wall too hard and it kills his day. But if he can maintain just Darlington stripe without killing it, then I think Larson's going to have a real shot.
For sure, yeah. He led the most laps last year. Probably should have won until Keselowski got by him late on a late restart and pulled away to the win. Neff, we got Eric Jones coming up on the show. We talked about him earlier in the show when we were, you know, discussing him and Christopher Bell. Currently 14th in points, 57 points above the cutoff. So good position to make the playoffs with two races to go. We kind of talked about this earlier, but what are your thoughts on Jones? And, you know, I truly think if he gets in, and last year, I mean, I went on a limb and picked him to go to the Final Four because he was getting hot at the right time. Turns out he had a terrible first round and was out in the first round. But I think he could be a sneaky pick maybe to get to the Final Four, but I would say definitely the Final Eight.
Yeah, I think he's got a shot. I mean, he's in JGR equipment, so you got to think he's got a shot just from that. Again, as I've said, I feel like he's getting better at communicating and getting his feel in his car, but I think he's also getting better at dealing with the car when it's not his ideal feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the key to being a champion and being a winner. And he's won a race, he's been close on some races, so he's learning how to win races. And once you do that, then you learn how to win championships. So it's going to be a bit yet, I think, but I feel like he is progressing. And again, we've seen so many of these young kids come up faster than they used to, and I think it's a matter of when you get to this level, it takes a while to learn. And he's on that learning curve, and I think he's moved down the curve pretty far, but he's still got a ways to go.
All right, enough with that said, let's get to my conversation with Eric Jones.
All right, 14th in points in the Cup Series this year. Overall, how would you gauge 2019?
You know, if you asked me the last 2 months how they went, I'd give us an A. But, you know, the whole year, I'd probably give us a C-plus just because of the start of the year. We had a rough, you know, first 3 months. We had some good runs in there, some top 10s, some top 5s, and even, you know, had an opportunity to win at Texas. But I still felt like we were lacking, and it wasn't necessarily some of it wasn't our own doing. Some of it was poor luck and circumstantial, but some of it was on us and some mistakes we made and mistakes I made. And we finally got those cleaned up and got to some good tracks. There's some tracks in the start of the season that aren't best for us. And once we cleaned those up, you know, we really hit our stride.
Yeah, you mentioned the mechanical failures. Some of the tire failures, I think, at the 600.
Yeah.
How frustrating is that going through that, knowing that you could have the speed because you see your teammates winning?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, especially at that point in the season, you know, the 600 was kind of a turning point for us. I felt like that was one of the best cars we had in a mile and a half this year, and still feel that way, that if we could have ran that race, we would have had a great shot to win. And, you know, being out on lap 20, I think it was frustrating. You know, DNFing on that early and being, you know, finishing dead last, it really hurts your points. And we had a couple races like that, and, you know, those add up quick, and it's taken us, as good as we've even ran the last 2 months, it's taken us all those good runs just to build back into the points where we should be. And we aren't even, you know, I don't think where we really deserve to be in the points. I think we should be higher up. So it's frustrating when you're running like that, but it is also calming knowing you've got the speed and you just got to put it all together.
Yeah, so you've got 8 top fives, which is more than a third of the schedule going into the weekend. The speed's been there, though, right, all year?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been there. I think if we you know, execute like we have been the last 2 months from the start of the year from Daytona on, you know, I think we have a bevy of top fives and top tens, and you never know, even maybe a win in there somewhere. If you run up front and you run like that continuously, you're going to win a race. You know, you can't keep running up front. So it's easy to look back and say and change the year how it could have gone, but all we can do now is focus forward and know that, you know, we are in a good spot to make the playoffs right now. We've got a good cushion. We've got 3 good tracks left for us, Bristol, Darlington, and Indy, and we just got to focus really on the playoffs now.
And I want to talk a little about the beginning of the year, because nothing, and you mentioned this, nothing could really go your way, the 20 teams away. What's that do to a driver's mentality?
Well, it's frustrating. You know, you don't necessarily, you know, for me, I don't think I ever lost confidence. I just was frustrated. You know, I was frustrated going to the racetrack and knowing that you're falling back in points. You know, your teammates are running well, winning races, and you know that your group can do the same thing, and when you're out there and you can't execute, it's just challenging. You know, you're working internally to make things better and make things right and fix the issues, but it takes time, and I think we're all impatient. We all want to fix things, you know, in the blink of an eye, and it just doesn't work like that. But, you know, the one calming factor I think we all had between myself and everybody on the 20 team was the speed. You know, we had runs where we could run up front, times where we ran up front, and that kind of kept us pushing forward to know that we could fix those issues and get up there.
What's it about the summer months that kind of leads to success for you? Because we've seen it over the past 3 years now.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it has been that way. I don't know if it's circumstantial or not, but it definitely seems like once we hit a little around Daytona, really, is when we start to hit our stride, and it was the same for this year again. I don't know. I mean, it's a combination of things, right? I think our team hit the stride the last couple of years right then, and I think it's a lot of good tracks for me, for JGR, continuously going to places I like and run well at in that whole stretch, and it just adds up to good finishes. You know, it's time to go and time to run well, and we're able to execute and hit it right, and it seems like that just seems to be our time of year when it's make the push and make the playoff.
As you mentioned, you're sitting comfortably in the playoffs now over the past 4 or 5 weeks of good runs. What do you feel like you need to improve on, the 20 team needs to improve on, to have a shot at the championship?
Well, I think we need to win races. You know, that's the biggest thing for us. So we've been up there right in the top 5, top 3, ran top 2, and just haven't quite broke through, and there's been some where we felt like we should have won, and there's been you know, races we've been in contention and just haven't closed out. We're in a good spot now with the point situation where we can push a little bit harder. We've had to kind of baby it, you know, Pocono and some other races to get those stage points and make sure we're running well and maximizing our points today. But with 70 points, you know, that's over a race now, and we have a race to throw away. We don't want to use that, but you know, you have that in the bank to at least be a little bit more aggressive at times.
Like, from an outside perspective, I thought last year was a shot. I picked you to go to the Final Four, and obviously the first round didn't go as planned.
Yeah.
With Las Vegas and the Louisville. But do you feel like the potential is there to make a shot at the Final Four?
I think it is. You know, me and Chris sat down and talked about things the other day in the championship run and what we could do. And looking at last year, you know, that first round obviously killed us. But the next round, I think our average finish was fourth, you know, between Talladega and the other two. I can't remember the other two tracks, but our average finish was really strong, and we could have definitely went on to the round eight running like that. So it was frustrating at that point to look at that, but you know, I know that we can do the same thing we did last year. We can run strong. Vegas is a great track for us, and we can go in and win one of those three races and make it pretty deep in the playoffs. I don't have any concerns about how we could make our playoff run.
I'm curious, how much do you lean on veteran drivers at JGR? Obviously, Martin, Denny, and Kyle.
Quite a bit. I mean, I was just even over talking to Kyle here in between Xfinity practices, just because, you know, especially in these cars, I don't have much experience in the last couple of years. So I'm picking his brain and asking him questions, and even on the Cup side, I still ask those guys questions. Definitely Kyle the most, because him and I know each other the best, and I feel like he knows how I drive and know what I look for in the car, so we can relate a little bit more on those things. But I still really use the other two guys' data a lot and look at what they do at certain places and ask them questions.
I asked Blaney the same question a couple weeks ago, but how frustrating is it when you know, obviously you want success for the organization, your teammates, but how challenging or difficult is it to see them winning and you've yet to be through, but even close?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you want to be up there winning. I mean, it hurts when you get close. You know, there's been a couple races where I'm like, you know, we could have won that one, we could have won this one, or if we could have done things a little bit differently. But, you know, you just have to do everything right, and it's challenging for me. You know, it's a good thing and a bad thing. I've got three guys who are all in their prime and all probably Hall of Famers in the future racing against me. So it's a tough test. I mean, it's tough to stack up against that competition, but it also it ups your game, right? You have something to look up to and something to strive for, and we want to be on the same level as those guys. And I know we're capable, and we just have to really put it together and get those couple wins. And if we could get two or three wins here before the season's out, I think that would change really a lot of things.
Is that a good personal challenge to have them? Because you know that, like you said, they'll probably be all Hall of Famers to run with them.
I mean, it is. You know, if you can run with those guys, you're running with the best guys that, you know, some of the best that have ever run in the sport. I mean, Kyle, Martin, and Denny are three of the best to do it. And, you know, running against them every week and the same and similar equipment is a real test of you as a driver. I mean, they really know what they're doing. They've been at it in the Cup Series for a long time, all of them over 10 years, and it really gives you a lot to stack up to and strive for. And it's easy to set a mark against them, right? You know that's where you need to be, so it's easy to live up to that.
I want to end with a couple of fun ones. How's Oscar?
He's good. He's two now, so he's getting a little bit older and a little wiser, I guess, but he still comes to the racetrack every week. We drove up here last night, so it's been really great having him around.
Just you and him drove up?
Me, him, and my girlfriend drove up last night, so it was good.
Got it. Now, when I look at your social media, you know, you have a lot of pictures like fishing or whatever, but not. I feel like a lot of people don't know the real Eric Jones. So what's like the day in the life of you?
I mean, for me, it's just kind of hanging out and spending time with friends. I mean, we always get together. It's rare I'm at home during the week at night just because we're getting out and going to dinner or whatever and just spending time. I'm real big on family and friends, and we spend a lot of time together. I recently got a boat, so we've been out on the lake a lot and learning to wake surf and all that stuff. So it's a little bit of everything. You know, I try to keep my horizons open in what we do, but definitely a lot of time spent with friends and family.
Now, we're going to Darlington next week, or 2 weeks, I guess. You got a cool throwback car, first late model race, right?
Yeah, it is. It's my scheme from my first year in late models, which, you know, is special for me. I picked that car out back when we were kind of putting that team together, and it's cool to see, you know, from that time racing those late models to now, obviously, and that's my 100th Cup start. Is that 100th? Yeah, 100th Cup start, so it's cool to kind of put that all together for one race.
Yeah, how special is that to you?
It is cool. I mean, we were talking about it, my buddy and I, that, you know, it's cool to see how far it's come in such a short amount of time, and that was obviously, you know, the real start of the journey to NASCAR was getting into late models and making that next step, and it was just cool how it worked out with that being the 100th start. I thought that would be a cool, you know, kind of throwback to that time.
Cool, man. Thanks for your time, Eric.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
All right, y'all. So there you have it. Great conversation there with Eric Jones, who last year I picked to go to the championship four, as you heard. But I think he's truly a dark horse this year for sure to get to the final eight this year, if not the championship four, though that might be a bit of a stretch. You could also say the same thing about last year, and I chose to pick him anyway. But I also enjoyed Eric letting us into getting to know the real Eric Jones just a little bit better. And fun conversation there with Neff as we dug deep into the Truck Series schedule, wishing there was more races to cover over the final 3 months of the year. But unfortunately, there's just 5 races remaining, and only one in the next 7 weeks. So something to look forward to going for the rest of the year. But that's it for this week's show. Again, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. But until next week's show, where we review Throwback Weekend at Darlington, we out.